I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. Imagine making a legal argument before a panel of judges. Let's just say, the U.S. Supreme Court. And in the course of your words, as you are speaking, suddenly you remember, yes, I have a jar of mustard in my pocket. Would that thought derail your presentation? Or maybe it would actually bring you good luck, like a good luck charm to see you through. Would anybody in the room clue into that hidden jar of mustard in your pocket? Would security be suspicious about what you were carrying? Well, our next guest here on Constant Wonder does come with a legal background and, in fact, teaches food law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Previously, he served as Assistant Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin, and indeed, he argued a case at the U.S. Supreme Court with a jar of mustard in his pocket. As we speak to him today, our first order of business may be to ask him, was it a pants pocket, a back pocket, a coat pocket, and was the mustard of high quality for that occasion? Barry Levinson is with us. Barry is founder and curator of the National Mustard Museum in Middleton, Wisconsin. Barry, welcome to our program.
Marcus, it's a pleasure to be here, and yes, indeed, I did argue a case at the U.S. Supreme Court with a little jar of mustard. It was one of those room service-sized jars that I had found on the way over to the court. I was staying at the Hyatt in Washington, and I saw it on a discarded room service tray. At the time, I had maybe 100, 150 jars in my collection. It was just a hobby at the time. And since nobody was looking, I figured, you know, as a good lawyer, I would take it. And sure enough, security let me go through. They said, what is that? I said, it's a jar of mustard. And I remember the marshal of the court saying, well, I've seen everything now. And I argued it with that little jar of mustard in my left pants pocket. I remember very clearly. And it was a good luck charm because it was a case that I won by the narrowest of margins, 5-4. We have that jar here at the Mustard Museum. Of course, now, 34 years exactly to the day after I began collecting jars of mustard, that is in a very cherished spot because it was 34 years ago today, October 28, 1986, when I began collecting jars of mustard. It was 2:30 in the morning.
It was 2:30 in the morning.
Oh,
there's,
yes.
There's a story there.
Oh, yes. You see, I'm originally from New England, and my beloved Red Sox had just lost the World Series. It was a terrible defeat because if baseball fans will remember the famous Bill Buckner error in Game 6 that led to Game 7, which was on October 27th, they lost, of course. I couldn't sleep, so I went to a nearby all-night grocery to walk up and down the aisles. I remember tears coming down my cheeks. And I said, this is crazy. Grown man bent out of shape because of a baseball game. Get over it. Get a hobby. So I said, I'll collect something. And at the time, I was walking down the condiment aisle. And I remember passing the ketchups and the olives and the relishes and the pickles, nothing. Suddenly, I was in front of the mustards, and I heard a voice that said, if you collect us, they will come.
No, you didn't.
Well, kind of. That is when I began collecting. It was actually as a remedy for my depression. Maybe the voice wasn't exactly as I
anticipated. Well, did you already like mustard at the time?
I did. I always liked mustard. I mean, I had become a foodie, I guess, even 34 years ago. Now it became more than just something I liked. It became, in a way, an obsession. And it became a way of life because 5 years later, I quit my job at the Department of Justice, and I opened what is now the National Mustard Museum. And from that first purchase, I think I maybe bought 10 or 12 jars. We now have the world's largest collection of mustards and mustard memorabilia. We have over 6,100 mustards, all over the place. From all 50 states are represented. I think 80 or 85 countries are represented. But in addition to just jars of mustard, we have, I think, some precious works of art. Old mustard tins, mustard pots, mustard poultices, mustard paintings or, you know, anything to do with mustard we have here at the National Mustard Museum.
You know, I just want to tell you that when I was a kid, I remember very distinctly my brother had sore feet once, and my mother applied a mustard poultice to his feet.
Yes.
Is that weird?
Well, before we had aspirin, before we had antibiotics, the mustard poultice, or plaster, as it's sometimes called, was probably the most common medicinal that doctors would recommend. So, you know, 120 years ago or so, when before we had aspirin and antibiotics, that was something that would be prescribed quite regularly.
So the medicinal properties of mustard, there's a long legacy there. And I would imagine that the museum and you have invested yourself in exploring that and revealing that to the world.
We have, because there was mustard oil that would be used, mustard plasters, mustard rubs, mustard ointments. In fact, in our new book, The Art of Mustard, we have a section devoted to mustard as medicine. And some just precious old mustard plasters and mustard artifacts where mustard was primarily seen as something that would heal you and make you feel better and would take care of just about everything that ailed you.
Well, if you've got a book out called The Art of Mustard, mm-hmm. if you're going to be comprehensive about this and if you're going to have any credibility about it, you really have to go back to square one. Historically, where does the mustard story start?
Well, we know that the ancient Egyptians would chew mustard seeds. We also know that in ancient Rome, mustard was a part of some of their sauces. But I would think, and I would say, and I think it's fairly clear, that mustard as we know it began around the 13th century by the monks of the old town of Dijon. You've heard of Dijon because everyone's heard of Dijon mustard. Well, it's a wonderful city southeast of Paris by about a three-hour train ride. And it's a wonderful city, and that's where mustard actually began.
The oldest mustard you have in your collection at the museum?
Oh, we have mustards from the 19th century for sure. And we have mustard memorabilia, mustard pots. It used to be that if you were getting married, you know, before we had blenders and food processors and Instapots, that's what you would get as a wedding present, maybe a set of mustard pots. And we have in our collection a whole bunch of sterling silver mustard pots from England. We also have one of our really most unusual pieces was a mustard pot, a ceramic mustard pot, that has the picture of the King of England and the Queen for their visit to Canada in 1939. It was a commemorative pot, and I've never seen one like it, so it's quite rare. This was something that was very significant because that was the trip that they took in 1939. They also came to the United States and were entertained by the Roosevelts at Hyde Park, and Mrs. Roosevelt decided, and this is absolutely true, she decided that she would serve a typical American meal. And what she served? Hot dogs with mustard.
Well, now you're just touched on something very important because you said hot dogs with fill-in-the-blank mustard.
Right.
You mentioned no other condiment.
Correct. I know there are people who put that red stuff on, and I hate to even mention its name. But if you look at the movie Sudden Impact, a Dirty Harry movie, at the very beginning, Dirty Harry says, no one puts ketchup on a hot dog.
Do you know of any ketchup museum anywhere in the country?
No, there was actually a small one that started many years ago, but it was quite small because there just aren't as many ketchups as you'll find mustards. We host the International Mustard Competition every year, and there are 17 categories which can be entered. So we get mustards from all over the world, from Sweden, from Japan. We've got them from Australia and New Zealand, because mustard is virtually universal. And the flavors, there's not just one mustard. There could be honey mustards, Dijon mustards, pepper mustards, garlic mustards, herb mustards, fruit mustards, deli mustards, good old American yellow mustard. We have exotic mustards. We have mustard-based barbecue sauces. All of them have a specific category at the Worldwide Mustard Competition. And that's something that is held every year. We have been overseeing the competition for about 25 or 26 years.
You mentioned 17 different categories, and I'm thinking perhaps these categories are about the different, I don't know, species or subspecies of mustard. How do you divide the categories?
No, the categories are the flavorings, because mustard seeds are typically either the brown seed or the yellow seed. And it's really the art of the mustard maker that determines the final flavor. So it may be flavored with beer. It could be flavored with honey. It could be flavored with fruit or vegetables. It could be just the classic yellow mustard. I think everyone's probably familiar with French's yellow mustard. They're really the first to popularize that. It goes back, I think, to 1904 when Mr. French decided that we needed a brightly colored mustard. And, of course, I don't know if people know this. Maybe you do, Marcus. What is it that gives mustard its bright yellow color when you get yellow mustard?
Well, I once had the unfortunate experience of walking under a swarming hive of bees and various types of pollen dripped upon me, but I don't think that's the answer.
No, it's actually turmeric. Turmeric is what, and it's often used, by the way, as a dye for clothing in India. So if you get a mustard stain on your tie, whatever, don't blame the mustard. It's probably the turmeric because that can be very difficult to get out. But we do have a tool here that does remove mustard stains. It's called a scissors.
Well, I want to walk into the museum now virtually because this is radio and I'm not in Wisconsin right now. But if I were there and I came in and it weren't COVID and so you were open and I could walk right in, right? If this,
well, yeah, and we do, because of COVID, we do require face masks for everyone who enters, and we have social distancing and we have capacity limitations. But if you walk into the museum, the first thing you're going to see is the Great Wall of Mustard. Probably if you look off the bit to your left, you will see that the Wall of Mustards would be mustards from the United States. You would then see some display cases with old mustard pots. You would see some mustard art as well on the walls. And you would also see a French's mannequin. A life-size French's mannequin that was the original costume, or, you know, the sports teams all have them.
Mascots? Is that what you were talking about?
Mascot, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay, I get it.
Yeah, the original French's mascot is here. There's an exhibit about French's mustard. We have an exhibit about Coleman's mustard. We have all kinds of little things that you can weave around the nooks and crannies and discover mustard pots, old tins. We have probably about over 500 antique mustard tins. It used to be that every region would have its own mustard tin. And we've got some of these, and they're great works of art. Many of them are pictured in The Art of Mustard, which people can get. Just go online and to mustardmuseum.com, and you can find just The Art of Mustard. You'll see it there. You'll also, of course, when you first enter, you go into the gift shop where there are more than 150 different mustards for sale in the separate gift shop. Normally, you can taste them. But, of course, with the COVID restrictions, we're not allowed to do either active or passive tasting. But we, our condiment counselors can advise you for whatever you need for the right mustard. And, yeah, it's been very difficult, of course, through the pandemic. This summer, which is usually our busy season, was kind of very sad. So if people want to help support a small museum, please do. And I hope people are supporting their small museums everywhere because it's been very difficult for
Absolutely.
For so many people.
It has been difficult.
It's been tragic.
Going back to this condiment counselor business, my understanding is that they're actually called confidential condiment counselors.
Indeed, they are.
Why would they need to be so confidential about this?
Well, because someone, you know, it's like a HIPAA. You know, I think in terms of, medical information, I don't think you want everyone knowing what mustard you're having. So, it's a confidential kind of thing. Other things that will happen quite often at the Mustard Museum, we will break out in song. What we'll do is probably sing the fight song for the Mustard College, which is located here.
You have and a college.
Oh, yes. It's called Poupon U.
Poupon. Poupon.
Poupon U.
Okay. So, thank you for that.
So people will do that. We've also created a mustard game. It's called Please Pass the Mustard.
Well, back to the song business.
Yes.
Are you willing to whistle or hum or something so I know get a flavor of what that is?
Oh, sure. How about if I even sing it as best I can?
Sure.
Sure. Here we go. The fight. Our number. We have two fight songs, but I'll sing you the first one. Are you ready?
I'm poised.
On our hot dogs, on our bratwurst, mustard is so cool. Never mayo, never ketchup. They're against the rules. Gleaming gold and mellow yellow, smooth, rough, sweet and hot. Poop on you, we'll fight and eat some lunch.
Did you commission that?
Of course. Actually, I wrote it about 25 or 26 years ago, because my son, who is now 33, he's almost 33, came in with the last line. He said, "How about eating some lunch, Dad?" So he was 7 at the time. I said, "Matt, you're part of the songwriting team." So that's what we did.
Well, in those lyrics, I heard never mayo, never ketchup. These really are fighting words.
Oh, yeah, they are. Yeah, we look at that. I mean, especially ketchup. Did you know, by the way, that ketchup is now the leading cause of childhood stupidity in America?
Get out of here. This is fake news.
Yes, it is. Well, according to the National Condiment Research Council annual report, that's what it says.
Yeah, you have to send one of those kids to a confidential counselor to get a little help of some sort. Yeah,
I mean, we do have fun. We are a real museum, and people, you know, we're a 501c3 organization, as most museums in the United States are. You know, the gift shop is separate from that. When you come here, you're going to see things that you say, "Is that for real?" So we do have our tongue firmly implanted in our cheeks, for sure.
I have to ask you.
I'm
just so curious because when I think about cuisine that leans heavily on mustard, I tend to think of Northern European, Germanic kinds of applications of mustard. I don't know why that is. You mentioned turmeric, and I know it's used around the world, but why would I think about, you know, Germans and mustard in particular?
Well, of course, you know, it's a very popular condiment in Germany. Also, of course, in France, but really all over Europe you'll find it. And really all over the world. In South America, there's quite a bit of mustard that's consumed there as well. And we have, I think, every South American country represented with mustards in our collection. But there are so many things you can do with mustard. Yes, you put it on a hot dog, you put it with on a deli sandwich, pastrami or corned beef, but it's also wonderful in a cream sauce. And it sounds very complicated, you know, an elegant mustard cream sauce. It's one of the easiest things. You reduce heavy cream after you've cooked something and put it in the pot. And when the cream boils and reduces in volume to about half of what it was, and it's nice and thick, turn off the heat and whisk in maybe a tablespoon or two of Dijon mustard, of non-sweet mustard. It's elegant. It's delicious. It's also something that you can use as the basis for a salad dressing, you know, a good mustard vinaigrette. My wife came up with a recipe for a walnut mustard vinaigrette that there was a walnut mustard that was one of our grand champions, and we tasted it on air with Oprah Winfrey. Oh, that was like about 20 years ago, And she said that was her favorite mustard, and so we designed this recipe that has now been printed by, you know, all over the world. It's our favorite thing to do with mustard. You use walnut mustard, walnut oil, and a nice light vinegar, and you dress a salad that's got toasted walnuts in it. Delicious. Lots of things you can do with mustard.
I could ask you about those superlatives. What's the hottest? What's the darkest mustard? What's the sweetest mustard? All that. But we don't have time for all of that. I'm just curious about the rarest mustard. And it might be one of the most expensive mustards if it's that rare. What, do you have a candidate for that category?
Well, some people would ask, well, what's the most expensive mustard in the gift shop? Because that usually has to do something with rarity. We have an elegant cognac mustard by Moutarde de Meaux, a Pommery company. Comes in an elegant black crock. We also have some truffle mustards. You know, it's truffle.
Those,
of course,
would be
very
costly,
expensive.
Yeah.
Very costly, just because of those ingredients. And, of course, that's a great thing to have on a hamburger. Really, that would be just is so phenomenal to have on a hamburger. So there's so many things that people can do with mustard. And when people learn about the non-culinary parts of mustard, the art of mustard, I think they begin to appreciate something that I think we all take for granted, or many people do. I certainly don't. You know, not with my 6,100 plus jars of mustard here that keep me company.
Well, Barry Levinson, yeah. We're out of time, but I just want you to know that I'm going to throw out my rabbit's foot and get myself a small jar of mustard for a good luck charm.
That's what you need for good luck. So people just, you know, go online, go to mustardmuseum.com, shop around, look for the Art of Mustard. Just search for Art of Mustard. You'll find it. It's a great book. It really is. It's really quite a treasure. We're very proud of it.
And remind me once more what you're celebrating. This is the anniversary of...
Yes, it was 34 years ago today when I found that mustard in the condiment aisle of that all-night supermarket. So it's a very special day for us. So thank you very much for having me as your guest.
Quite the epiphany, walking down the grocery store aisle and finding a hobby.
Yeah, it is. You know, you never know. You meet the most interesting people at 2:30 in the morning.
Barry Levinson with us. He's founder and curator of the National Mustard Museum in Middleton, Wisconsin. And recently he has a book out called The Art of Mustard. Now, if you stipulate that it's not going to contain ketchup, I suppose that one condiment museum calls for yet another. If you can collect mustard, then certainly somebody somewhere is collecting vinegar. And that is so. Indeed, there is such a person, and we found him. Also, this person way off the beaten path. There is no Metropolitan Museum of Mustard, which is kind of a sad thing because that would be lovely for the sake of alliteration. The Vinegar Man is going to join us when Constant Wonder returns in just a moment. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. It's time now for one of our segments we like to call What's in This? And usually what's in this has to do with some kind of a food, but I'm going to get things rolling with what's in the word vinegar before we get to the vinegar itself. What's in that word? I like words and language and poetry and such. So vinegar. Lexically, it comes from vinum, which is Latin for wine. It's spelled with a V, so after classical Roman times, it became vinum. Plus the root for acetum or acer, which is Latin as well. It designates something sour. So wine that has soured is vinegar, all the way back to ancient times. But now what's in the stuff itself, not just the word? What is it? Why is it useful? Why do we care? And to help answer that question, we have on the line with us the Vinegar Man, Lawrence Diggs, from the International Vinegar Museum in Roslyn, South Dakota. Lawrence Diggs, thanks so much for joining with us.
Thank you for having me.
I just got off Google Maps an hour ago. I wanted to check out the street where this museum is. You are about 200 miles west of Minneapolis, as the crow flies. And the museum, a very small, quiet main street there, small town charm, its simple red brick structure, its rural America. I went down the street a little bit. You know how you can do that on Google? And I saw the Dakota Bank and Dakota Insurance. I saw the little post office across the street. There's even a rug weaving shop down on the next corner. And you go much further than that, and suddenly you're out of town. You're in a small place, aren't you?
That's right. We've got about 180 people here.
What took you to a town of 180 people? I mean, this is small.
Yeah. Well, actually, I grew up in San Francisco, and I was looking for a place that you can get away from the city. And I wanted to get far enough away so that it would be really quiet. And so I was looking for about 4 years or so all around the U.S. to find a kind of a home away from home, like people get a second house on the lake or something like that. And one day a real estate agent called and said, "Hey, I think I got a place for you. Maybe you wanted to go take a look at it." And long story short, I flew out. I liked the place and it kind of seemed to like me. And so I initially was just going to come out here in the summertime and spend a couple of weeks. So it was going to be kind of like a vacation house. But then I got here and the people treated me like I was, you know, I'd always lived here. And so pretty soon I decided, oh, I'm traveling all over the world. Doesn't really matter where I'm leaving from. Why don't I just come and stay here? And so there I was. So I came here about 30 years ago.
Well, the thing that's so interesting about your past is that you've had a lot of homes away from home, from Burkina Faso to Japan. And as a world traveler, to be in such a secluded place, and you brought vinegar to that town, I think. I'm not sure you arrived. You were studying vinegar long before you got to South Dakota.
Yeah, I was in I had been studying food science, and I kind of got into vinegar because I was doing food science, trying to learn how to reverse engineer food so that poor people could eat better was kind of my mission. And I got this assignment to write a kind of a term paper. And when I was looking around for something to write about, I didn't want to do bread because I'd been making bread since I was a kid and that wasn't interesting so much to me. And I didn't want to do wine because I didn't drink or beer and things like that. But then there was this vinegar thing and I thought, well, let me check that out. So I went to the library to try to find something about vinegar, and I couldn't find any books. And I asked the librarian, well, how do I find a book on vinegar? And she said, at that time we had these odd things called card catalogs. and so she said, well, just look at the card catalog. You'll find something over there. And I said, I looked, and there was nothing. She said, oh, that can't even be possible. So she looked, and she couldn't find it anyway. We didn't have Google then either. But what they did have, internet connection, like these kind of email kind of things. And they had a list. The libraries had a list that they, if they were looking for a book or something like that, they could basically get in touch with all the libraries in the world. And that was on their system anyway. And search for the book. And they couldn't find one book in print in the English language on vinegar, which is a kind of an odd thing when you think vinegar is probably the most common man-made condiment in the world after, you know, salt, which isn't really man-made, but just kind of harvested, and pepper or something like that. But in terms of like a manufactured product like that, vinegar is, you know, right up there in the top anyway. But at any rate, there was no book. And so long story short, I wrote that book.
And yeah, there was a gaping hole in the science here. You discovered the hole. So let's get into the substance itself. And you're the vinegar man. You've got the vinegar museum there. People turn to you for consultation about the stuff. Where should we start? I mentioned wine and souring. Is it always a sour process?
Technically, yes, because if it doesn't have acetic acid, then it's not vinegar and acetic acid is going to be sour. Having said that, though, the stuff that people use for window washing fluid, that is distilled vinegar, that's a kind of a poor representation of what vinegar is. It's like saying vodka is alcohol or moonshine or something is alcohol. Well, you have all of these other iterations of that. And you have to be pushing that, you know, so that you get, you're left with just the central ingredient. Just like in other alcoholic beverages, it's all those other things that mellow that out. In vinegar, that's the same case. You know, it's the distilled vinegar is just the essential ingredient that is required for us to be able to call it vinegar. But it's all of the other things that it's are that makes it an interesting condiment for us to use. If you're going to use it for window washing or cleaning your linoleum or something like that, you want the distilled stuff. That it's good for that.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you would be very dissatisfied with vinegar if it were just that acetic acid. That's like a necessary condition, but for you, wholly insufficient to the broad range of the diverse manifestations of this. You take delight in the breadth and the diversity of this.
Yes, I do. And I should say that, you know, I kind of grew up a lot in Japanese culture. And in Japan, for the most part, you can't find distilled vinegar in a grocery store. And if you do, it's in the hardware section, because you know? that's where you buy it normally, is at the hardware store. Because when you make vinegar in a natural process using natural materials and you don't distill it, then what you have is this rather mellow substance that it's sour, but in some ways not as sour and not as sharp as lemon. It's a whole different product when it's not distilled.
I'm amazed at how many different original materials you can begin with to generate vinegar. It doesn't all come from grapes, or maybe never did all come from grapes.
Yes, that's interesting. You know, our word vinegar comes from kind of the French. It goes through the French line from the Latin. And the French were into mostly making their vinegars from wine. Pasteur, by the way, made his money more in vinegar than he did in milk, which is what we know it as. But it really was saving all of those French wineries from their wines turning into vinegar that he gained his kind of notoriety through his methods of being his discoveries made it possible to discover why they were turning into vinegar and then to stop that from happening. In the process, they learned that you can actually refine and make vinegar. So that area where he was became quite well known for making vinegar. So you can make vinegar out of anything that has enough sugar or starch in it. It's made from not only various fruits, but most of the vinegar in the world is made from grains, that is to say from rice or wheat or things like that. You can make it from grasses like sugar cane. You can make it from quite a bit of vinegar is made from coconuts. It's even made from milk, though I don't really like that particular product. But it's made from anything that has enough sugar or starch in it. We can turn the starch into sugar, the sugar into alcohol, and the alcohol into acetic acid, and then we have vinegar.
I'm curious about home production because there are a few crazes out and about here in the pandemic. People are making a lot of bread at home. Sourdough starts are very popular. People will make their own yogurts at home. Is it advisable for people to make their own vinegar?
Yes and no. Okay, so the yes part is it's doable. The no part is most people don't have the equipment or the know-how to be able to reliably test the vinegar for its ability to preserve foods. That said, if you just want it for a condiment, like, you know, like to put it on a salad or something like that, and you don't have to be assured of its ability to inhibit other microorganisms, you can do a pretty good vinegar pretty simply. In fact, if people drink wine or something like that, they probably notice that if they leave the top off of it for a while, that wine will just by itself turn into vinegar. And many people throw away better vinegar than they go out and buy because they think of the vinegar as just spoiled wine, which is like saying wine is spoiled grape juice. You know, but you can make it. People do. I have so much now that people send me to test that I don't really make it unless I'm doing a lab experiment or something like that, just to see if I'm testing somebody else's idea out. But I figure my job is really to encourage other people to try different things, because there's so many possibilities that, you know, I know I'm not in the race. I just help other people be better racehorses.
So if you're going with the starch and the sugar, and that's the starting point, and maybe this comes from plant material, and then can you bypass the alcoholic stage that is the part of the wine turning to vinegar? Can you go directly to the acid content, or is that always part of the process that goes through an alcoholic stage?
Well, for most of human history, that has been the case, and now people have cultured out a sometimes hard to find culture of something called gluconobacters. And I don't want to get too techie on people, but it's a kind of acetobacter. And for many years in the, we have a kind of a manual that we look in to describe bacteria and stuff like that, microorganisms. And it went back and forth whether gluconobacters were just mutated acetobacters and whatnot. But right now there seems to be a rather stable line of gluconobacters, which they can eat sugar directly and turn it into alcohol. And they can handle high concentrations of sugar minus alcohol. And that's something that the acetobacters can do, but they prefer to eat alcohol. So as far as a straightforward way that people are able to do in their houses, they're probably still going to be needing an alcohol phase. That said, it's not unheard of in some cultures that people do go through that. And I haven't looked at what organisms they use. For example, in the Philippines, when they make a coconut vinegar, basically, let's say they drain a tree of sugar, kind of like taking sap. It's not really off the tree. It's from the kind of, there's a kind of a nub that forms when coconuts are going to grow. And then they take the sugar out of that, and they go pretty much to coconut vinegar from there, kind of in the villages and stuff like that. I didn't have equipment, you know, to be able to even look at those organisms, let alone do test on them. But as far as I could tell, they were acetobacters, but acetobacters are quite well known for mutating. So I'm not sure what's going on there, but that's a long answer to yes, it's possible, but most people are not going to do it.
Well, where this is all leading to in my mind is the idea that if people are talking about fine wines or a fine cheese, sometimes there's an aging process. And just the fact that there are different phases involved in the generation of this, is there such a thing as vinegar being better or worse for age?
Vinegar is often usually helped by aging of some kind, especially when you're making it as ordinary people would be making it, not in a, you know, using an acetator, but actually, you know, just sort of like we call a let alone or Pasteur method. The aging part really can help because it takes a little bit of that sharpness off the front end. So it's not so biting, even though it's just as sour. It also gives it time, you know, all the different kind of molecules are in there to kind of form different taste components. You can enhance some vinegars with the aging process that involves wood, much the same as you would for whiskeys or some wines. I used to think that all of them were, you know, like, you know, you'd use some oak or some kind of wood. But after I got, you know, like, more experience with different kind of vinegars, many of them, they don't really improve that much, if at all, with wooding, you know, adding wood to it. But sometimes you can sort of have like sort of wood flavored vinegar, which is not, you know, I guess that's what oak is too. It's kind of like you add, but you don't want to just, it doesn't need to taste like oak. You just want the oak to kind of like influence it and make it a little bit more mellow, make it smoother. When you do your balsamics, they use lots of different kinds of wood. So, you know, all that aging, yes, it can play a very good part. And I would think any kind of vinegar that you make, it can benefit from about 6 months of aging anyway.
If anybody really wants to get into this, of course, they would have to go to your reference guide. And I want to mention the title of that again, Vinegar, the User-Friendly Standard Text Reference and Guide to Appreciating, Making, and Enjoying Vinegar. The author is Lawrence Diggs, the Vinegar Man. It's such a pleasure to have a moment or two with you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we did succumb to the temptation, and we've made it Condiment Hour for the entire hour here on Constant Wonder. First mustard, then vinegar. And when we come back after a short break, we're going to talk about a very surprising condiment. Don't worry, ketchup lovers, by the way. You're going to have your day on the show here. But it's not ketchup. We're headed for a condiment. Well, have you ever heard of this before? Have you ever heard of grease described as a condiment? Stick around and you're going to hear an argument that is made in behalf of grease as a condiment. Very surprising. Very shocking. Constant Wonder returns in a moment. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're talking about condiments this hour, at least a few of them. Vinegar, check. Mustard, check. What about grease? George Motes is author of the Great American Burger Book, How to Make Authentic Regional Hamburgers at Home, and he argues that grease is indeed a condiment.
If you eliminate grease, you don't have enough fat in your burger, you're going to be shorting yourself one of the greatest flavors, I think, on earth.
Well, let's talk about this tallow versus lard business. Is that very scientific?
Sure. I mean, cooking is obviously science anyway, but definitely cooking in fat is definitely a science.
And the distinction between tallow and lard?
Well, just a very straightforward definition. The tallow is rendered beef fat and lard is rendered pig fat, pork fat.
And both of them can burn. Because I think of tallow candles. Didn't they make candles out of those tapers?
They did. Yes, exactly. Yeah. It is a very, very high... low burning points. It'll smoke fast, unfortunately. That's the downside of tallow. I mean, if you cook it at a low temperature, you can actually do some great things with tallow, for sure.
So if I go to a burger joint and they're serving what they call a char burger, is it the grease that's burning? Is it the tallow?
Well, that's a great question. So no, a char burger is actually cooked over a flame. And what's happening is there's some crazy science going on there, for sure, because when you put a hamburger patty on over a flame, the grease renders, the fat renders from the hamburger and actually drips into the fire. Once the grease hits the fire, it actually ignites and it releases all these carbonic compounds that go up into the area where the burger's cooking and lands, you know, gently back on top of the burger again to create that smoky flavor. So that's really what's happening there. That's a different science.
Well, let's go to Memphis, Tennessee now, because I have mentioned it, and Dyer's Burgers. Have you been there lately?
Last time I was there was probably about 2 years ago, alive and well, doing great.
And they have quite a history, I understand, going back. Tell us about the age of this grease they cook with.
They started cooking with grease in the early part of the 19th century. 20th century, I'm sorry, that far back. but 1904, I believe it was. I don't have my year exactly in front of me right now, but it's been over 100 years since they've been making burgers cooked in deep fat.
Not quite colonial burgers.
No, not quite colonial burgers, but turn of the century. The turn of the century when hamburgers were just starting to become a thing. People were trying to find different ways to make burgers. And the great story with Dyer's is that what they would do is they would make burgers in a skillet. This is, of course, you know, in 1900, this, of course, predates any kind of flat top or any kind of, you know, outdoor flame grill, backyard grilling. Back then, you made a burger, you cooked it in a skillet, which had sides on it, obviously. And then when you cooked in a skillet and you cooked a burger, what happened was all that fat would render. The rendered fat would then stay inside the skillet. The more burgers you made, the deeper the fat would get. At some point, it would become a deep-fried burger. You're deep frying your burgers in beef tallow. And if a guy was working in a restaurant, he's got orders coming in, order after order. There's no time to drain off the fat. People actually kind of like the fact that it was deep fried. It was adding a lot more flavor to the burger. So at that point, the deep fried burger was born.
Now, the thing about Dyer's that I've come across is the idea that they have not necessarily discarded the fat after cooking. they make this claim, it's kind of outlandish, that the grease is 108, 109 years old.
what they do in this great, this is a really great story, of course, you know, it, I love a good burger story, especially when it involves, you know, a place that's over 100 years old. And it's true. They actually, they've been using the same skillet, if not the same skillet, for decades and decades. What they like to say is that every time they've transferred the grease, the beef tallow, from one pan to the next, from one location to the next, they have always kept, you know, some of the oil from yesterday to use today. And that's been going on for over 100 years. So they do believe that they're in there somewhere. There are molecules from the very beginning.
Yeah, it's kind of biblical in its proportions there. You've got this miraculous oil that's just kept around and keeps flowing forth. Would you tell me, if you would kindly, also about the stories about them moving from one location to another restaurant with police escort?
Right. Well, there was the owners at the time were they had to move out of the neighborhood, which was kind of going a little bit downhill back then. And they moved. They were actually embraced by the city. The city decided to make them a tourist attraction right on Beale Street in Memphis. They were embraced by the city, and the mayor showed up, and they decided to do this, make it even a bigger fanfare, a larger fanfare by including a police escort. The news media came out, and it became a big deal. And it was important, I think, to show the public that, you know, this is a hamburger restaurant that was not messing around. They were taking their grease, the deep fried burger, very seriously, and they were going to move the grease by police escort, and it became newsworthy.
Well, it's certainly a great marketing ploy. If the flavor isn't really in that old grease, it's a ploy. But maybe the flavor is in the old grease.
Could be. I don't know. There are a lot of places in America that, believe it or not, that actually still to this day cook in beef tallow. So they're not alone.
You're talking about cooking things other than the beef itself.
No burgers. I mean, there are. I mean, once I discovered Dyer's, I've started getting emails and text messages of people saying, oh, you missed this deep-fried burger place and this deep-fried burger place. I've discovered a ton. I recently made a list. I've discovered about 9 or 10 in America that are in my book alone that are still making burgers in deep, in either deep fat or in oil.
Well, this invites us now to consider other types of oil because it sounds really sketchy to me, but why would you cook a burger in peanut oil or butter or some other kind of oil other than the oil that comes with it?
Who knows? At 1990, McDonald's stopped using beef tallow for their fries. But it was not that long ago, only 30 years ago. But it really was a major change for them. And they did it, they said, for, quote, you know, health reasons. But I really believe that stuff cooked in animal fat is much better for you than stuff cooked in, you know, a science experiment. You know, the oil, a lot of vegetable oils are not really healthy for you at all. I think you're much better off in moderation, you know, taking in animal fats, for sure.
Well, if you're right, then you've just made a case for actually calling that stuff vitamin G.
Exactly.
Well, it's quite a claim, actually. You think, I'm going to repeat you as I heard you. I heard you say that you think it's healthier to just use that animal fat when cooking a burger.
I do. I truly believe that because if you look at our generation, the last three generations in America, we're all overweight. We're all have a little bit of fat on us, and I believe it has a lot to do with the way we're eating, the way we're enjoying food right now. You look back to our generation before that. You go back to my grandparents; they were all thin. They were none of them were overweight, and they were actually enjoying food cooked in lard, food cooked in beef tallow, and not really thinking much about it. But they were definitely, you know, they probably weren't eating as much as we were. They're not eating, definitely weren't eating a whole lot of processed food back then, for sure. And they were all thin.
Well, the big difference in my family history is that even though the farmers of previous generations would fry their eggs in bacon grease, they had a lot of hard work to do, and they burned a lot of calories.
They did. They burned a lot of calories off, for sure. No question about it. Yeah, but I believe that the general switch in food in the 60s and 70s has definitely affected us. We have to really think about what we're eating. I think back then you ate stuff that tasted fantastic, and a lot of times it was cooked or made somehow with animal fats.
So in your roving about the country and sizing up the different burger establishments, have you found places that say we use butter?
Yeah, for sure. Butter as a condiment as well is another one. It's another great one. There's a restaurant in Glendale, Wisconsin, right outside of Milwaukee, called Sally's. And Sally's, they claim to have, and I believe them, that they invented the Butterburger. The Butterburger, of course, coming from the dairy state, this makes perfect sense. It was a burger that literally had a big two tablespoon, I'm not kidding, a 2-tablespoon dollop of soft Wisconsin creamy butter on the burger. And so what happens is this, if you're lucky enough, when the burger arrives at your spot at the counter, the butter hasn't totally rendered out yet. Some of it is actually still in a sort of a semi-solid state. You bite into that burger and you get the elements of beef, butter, and bun all together. It's a pretty extraordinary sensation.
I have to confess that I'm very partial to taking the bun and dipping it in the grease, you know, right there in the skillet. That's quite the American tradition, too.
It really is, and it's sort of hard to not do that. You dip that bun back in there because your brain is saying, no, you have to do this. This is what you should be doing. You don't know why you're doing it. But for some reason, you're actually thinking to yourself, how did all that butter escape? What's it doing down there? I'm going to dip into that butter on the plate and take some. It's true.
Well, everything we've been talking about is such an indulgent activity, you know, to be doing this, because we do live in a day and age when people are counseling us against that for years and years. People are saying, you know, go for the lean meat and all of that. And you've made the argument, well, that compromises the flavor. Now you're saying there's maybe something healthier about not using the peanut oil maybe or the vegetable oil. I'm wondering if you have encountered a whole lot of naysayers, a lot of people who are taking you on.
Of course, there's a lot of people who don't understand what cooking oil is to begin with. They don't even know where it comes from. The carbonic compounds that actually come out of the burning. If you have burning vegetable oil, it's much, much more dangerous than if you have burning animal fat going up your nose. That's for sure. It's very dangerous. I believe it's very dangerous, and I don't really know the exact facts. I'd rather be in a kitchen where there's beef tallow, you know, smoke happening than vegetable oil or canola oil smoke happening for sure.
George Motes there. He's author of the Great American Burger Book, How to Make Authentic Regional Hamburgers at Home. I hope you have a great Labor Day weekend, but before you slip away, let me tell you about next week. You may not think that rats and dogs compare very well for heroism or for work, but if you're out looking for landmines, maybe it's best to go with a rodent.
Rats, like dogs, have a very good sense of smell. And through positive behavioral reinforcement training, you can get them to indicate very accurately on the smell of TNT, which we're doing here, which is what's found in most mines. It's really a somewhat of a similar process to dogs. Dogs, though, work more for affection. Rats work for a food reward. And one other interesting fact between rats and dogs is dogs are bond forming. So they're working for the affection of one individual trainer they know well. Rats actually are just working for food. So they can be transferred between trainers much more easily, which is an advantage in the field.
We'll bring you that story on Tuesday here on Constant Wonder. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.